Hey, and happy Tuesday. Hope everybody in the States enjoyed their July 4th weekend. I am Ryan Duffy, Managing Editor of Payload and your host. And today we have a very special guest. He is actually my boss, Mo Islam, co-founder and CEO of Payload. And I'm personally very excited for this conversation. I'm a little nervous. I hope I don't say anything that gets fired. But before we dive in, I just want to say a word from our sponsor. Our reliance on satellites for navigation, communications, commerce, and intelligence has grown exponentially in the new space economy. Unfortunately, the risks have grown as well, and the need to prioritize cybersecurity around space assets is critical. Spider Oak Mission Systems provides space cybersecurity products for military, commercial, and civilian operators. Their Orbit Secure solution is the first to deliver zero-trust security to zero-gravity environments, protecting space communication, command, control, data transmission, storage, and integrity at the data level. To learn more about Orbit Secure, check out their website at spideroak-ms.com. Again, that is spideroak-ms.com. And without further ado, let's get into the main event. Mo, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ryan. I appreciate the intro. I'm very excited and glad and honored to be on the show. And I'm sure the listeners will understand that no one was forced here.
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah, blink twice, Ryan.
I'm excited for this one.
I am too, and I have to confess, it sort of feels like the Spider-Man pointing meme, where it's like two Spider-Men pointing at each other. It's like a payload to payload interview. Anyways, before we dive into the macro update, which is going to be fascinating, I'm really excited for. Can you just give a really really brief resume? Just tell everyone who might not be familiar about your background, maybe up until you decided to start Payload.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let me see how far back I should start. I've always been interested in space economy. Actually going into college, I went to school in Boston, Tufts. I thought I was going to be a physics major. And then without getting into the full story, I was basically convinced that it would be better to study econ and go into Wall Street in New York, which is where I'm from.
The dark side.
And, I had a very convincing roommate. The dark side is what is exactly right. And, I'm not afraid to say it. I sold my soul, went back to New York, and joined Wall Street and, basically started a career at JP Morgan. And probably pretty much immediately I was like, uh-oh, like this probably is not what I want to actually do. So I thought long and hard about how can I structure my career and start doing what I've always wanted to do, which is really work in the space economy. But if I can't work in the space economy because, you know, it's too much work to go back to school and study engineering and try and work for NASA, like, is there other ways I can support the industry? And it was through financing. So I spent a lot of time working on building a practice within the banks, figuring out how we can help finance space deals. And while I was at JP Morgan, one of the first deals we did was SpaceX back in 2015, which was exciting. And we did a few more over the course of the years that, you know, for me was like, okay, this is sort of my contribution to the industry. Helping at least support the industry from a financial perspective or using other institutions' capital. So I did that. I also then after my stint at JP Morgan, I spent a couple of years at Deutsche Bank building out a practice there. Thinking about sort of how to continue supporting the space economy and through various different financing mechanisms. Worked on a SPAC deal that I will not name here, but it was a definitely interesting one. I was able to see kind of behind the scenes how the sausage was made, and we can definitely talk about that later because I have a lot of thoughts. During that time, I just I felt like there was this really big gap in media coverage within the space economy, specifically around the startup community. And the startup community was really shaping a lot of the growth and innovation, and I just felt like they weren't being covered as much. So I decided to, at the beginning, I was like, I'm going to start an investor newsletter and send it to sort of my network. And Ari, my co-founder, was a good friend of mine. I'd known him for a number of years. He knows media really well. He was listening to my thought and was like, "Hey, have you ever heard of B2B media?" And I said, "No, I have no idea what that is." So he kind of
define the acronym for our audience, for anyone who might not be familiar.
Yeah, so B2B, so effectively business to business, which is like when you're writing to, when you have, it's not always a niche audience, but maybe when you're catering not necessarily to consumer audience, but an industry focused audience.
Yeah, having come from a more consumer focused media company, I always like to say that it's really not about the quantity or the list size, which we kind of consider internally as a vanity metric. It's about the quality. It's about who is reading it. Just wanted to interject and point that out.
Correct. No, that's exactly right. But it's also like, you know, when Ari came to me and said, "Hey, we should do this," I was like, "How does this even work? Is that even interesting media? Like, why would I want to start a media company?" So it took some, I'll be honest, it took some convincing, but you know, he really knew what the roadmap was going to look like, and you know, we decided to try it. So we actually look back, and I find it really funny. Our first ever newsletter. And I was writing it, you know, before you obviously took over and vastly improved it. But when I was originally writing it, it was very like our first newsletter was super technical and very investor focused. And I remember Ari like calling me like after we sent out the first one. He was like, I couldn't understand like 90% of what you were writing. Like, and we decided we needed to take a step back and write to more of an industry audience. And that's when really the payload in essence began. And when we started to look at our subscriber list and saw organic signups from like public company CEOs, which happened within like the first like couple months, we thought to ourselves, okay, maybe there's really something here. And we decided to really build out a roadmap for a proper company. And we ended up raising a round last summer. We brought in some great investors, and you know, our first hire was you. And we're very, very happy. We couldn't have hit the nail on the head better. But you know, we always knew from the very beginning that like, you know, I'm not a writer, I'm not a journalist. I'm not going to be the person that's like takes the newsletter to the next level. So we really needed someone with experience who knew what they were doing. And you know, when we heard that you might have been looking for a new role, and to be quite honest, we weren't even sure about that. We were just like taking a gamble. I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah, yeah. Now who's holding who hostage? Just kidding.
there you go.
I think A plus on the resume, C minus on making it an elevator pitch, but that's okay because I think that you just set the scene and established your qualifications, credentials, and sort of bona fides for why you are able to speak so intelligently on what you are about to discuss. So let's transition over to establish some context for our audience. This is an adapted deck of what Mo presented internally at our offsite last week in upstate New York. And, you know, there's some information about payload, but there's much, much more about the industry that we're covering, the governments that we're covering, the geopolitics, the history, the economics of all of this. And so as he was presenting it, I said to him, "I don't know why we would keep this. We need to share this with the world. I think people will benefit. People will be interested. People will engage with this content." So without further ado, Mo, let's have you share your screen.
Yeah. And I also obviously understand that there are going to be people that can't see this or may not see this. So
I'll add, this is an inducement for you to watch Payload. You'll get the full picture, obviously. Literally, you'll get the video. So we'll have this on YouTube or Spotify. But we know we love all of our audiophiles and everyone listening to this podcast, which is the vast majority of you at this point. So we will include descriptions of everything so that no one is left out. All right, Mo. Over to you.
Awesome. Thank you. I'll just say one thing. I can't actually see you, so I won't be able to see any verbal cues. So just interrupt me anytime if you have a thought or question or just something that you want to add to it. But really,
I might just gesticulate wildly, but
perfect.
No promises.
So I think what Ryan was alluding to was really giving an introduction to is this presentation. was really meant for, you know, at the end of the day, we're a startup, and it was really important for us, at least I thought, for us to talk about what was happening around the world. And I used to work in banking, so it was something I lived and breathed for quite some time in terms of, like, you know, what was happening within the macro economy. But, you know, I haven't been in that role for quite some time. So, you know, I felt like I needed also a refresher on what was happening. So that was really the point and gist of this, but I'll just jump right into it. So this first page is a Bloomberg Business Week cover from April 2019. And on the cover, it says, "Is inflation dead?" Right. And at the time, the annual rate of the CPI stood at 2%. And there was all this talk and sort of conversation within the business world that, you know, the Fed was lowering rates, but, you know, they just couldn't get any inflation. Right. But of course, that was not the case, because as of the latest CPI report, you know, we hit 8.6%, which is the highest headline CPI print since 1981. And I think that this is, you know, we don't need to get into sort of how we got here, because Fed stimulus, you know, we saw a lot of capital creation from the Fed over the last couple of years as a result of the pandemic. But really, I think what we need to think about is looking ahead in June. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'll just add that this, as I mentioned, this was adapted, but initially, this slide was just an 8.6%. And you asked the team, you're like, does anyone know what this number was? And I said something like, I think it's the latest inflation print, which just goes to show, you know, I am the editorial lead at Payload and write a newsletter about the industry, space investing, like policy, that sort of thing. But these numbers, these prints have become so important that, like, anyone who's on Twitter or paying attention, who reads Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg frequently, like, these prints are etched into everyone's short-term memory.
Yeah. And that's a great point. That's a really good point. I don't think, like, 6 months ago, anyone would have any idea what the CPI print was, right? But now it's etched in our mind. But the June number is actually scheduled to be released on July 13th. So in about 2 weeks. And it's a hugely important reading, because if it comes over expectation, which is around 8.7%, I believe is the latest consensus number, then you're likely going to see another leg down in equity markets, because it's going to imply that the Fed has more to go in terms of rate hikes. And not just that, right? 2 weeks after that CPI print, we're going to actually get the second quarter GDP growth number. So why is that important? So if you recall, Q1 GDP growth was minus 1.6%, so a 1.6% contraction. And the technical definition of a recession is two successive quarters of contractionary GDP growth. So that's going to be a number to look out for. The Atlanta Fed has a GDP model that estimates GDP growth every quarter. And I think their latest estimate is that second quarter number is going to be 0.0%. So in other words, we're like playing it real close. But, you know, I think it is a technical recession if we get that contractionary number. But I think the more important thing is, how does it affect consumer sentiment? Because when people feel like, oh, we are in a recession, it does drastically change the way people spend money and the way investors invest. And, you know, here's a chart. It's a chart of global food prices. And really the point here is that, you know, we are in a food crisis, right? This is one of the results of, you know, the war. But we are, you know, for the first time since 1972, both food and energy prices are increasing simultaneously. And if you even look sort of under the hood, you know, things like wheat prices are up almost 50%. Globally, food costs are up more than 50% since mid-2020. And social unrest is a huge issue. You know, we don't see it here in the U.S. because we're very lucky. But across countries like Tunisia, Sri Lanka, Peru, Pakistan, people are rioting. Like, you can, like, Google this. Like, there are riots in the streets, right? There was a trending YouTube video, like, not very long ago about, like, the riots in Sri Lanka. And it's all because, you know, people can't pay for food. And it's a really, really big problem.
Yeah. So this is all fascinating. And on the topic of that next print, if it's below, you know, zero, I think what you said the Atlanta Fed was expecting, what is the Mo Fed? What does the Mo Islam Fed expect? And if it is indeed below or substantially below zero, is that priced in?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't spend nearly as much time on this kind of thing as I used to, So what I would say, though, is if I was a betting person, I would say it's going to come in below zero. I don't believe the market is expecting a technical. Well, actually, let me say it differently. Everyone's talking about a recession. So perhaps the market is expecting a technical recession, right? Because everyone, usually when everyone talks about something, the opposite happens in sort of Wall Street. But in this specific situation, if I was betting, I do think
Jim Cramer.
Exactly. If I was really predicting, I think it's going to come in below zero.
Okay. And on the topic of the global food crisis, you know, that's obviously super important, more important than probably any other variable that we're talking about today. But can you explain to me why that is in a space startups slide? And, you know, I'm making this a pretty leading question by saying I know the macro, it's all connected. But yeah, can you walk our listeners through that just a bit?
Yeah, no, it's a very fair question. I would say, look, macro is all connected, right? Everything everything has an impact. Something that might happen overseas does have an impact on what we're doing here to an extent, because we're so connected these days from a globalization perspective. More importantly, for me, it was more just like an awareness, like, hey, this is not necessarily affecting our day to day, but we really do need to know about what's happening because it's become so off base, that, you know, this is just something we need to we need to be thinking about. Right. So it kind of goes beyond just like what we're doing as a space startup.
100%. And I think that you also see that very clearly. In our own lives, you know, consumer electronics, automobiles, whatnot, but also very clear, the supply chain and all the issues and disruptions with supply chain and just all of these, the force majeure events. I probably mispronounced that, but anyways, I'm actually getting a little bit ahead of you because I mentioned autos. So let's jump to that next slide.
Yeah, well, it's a great lead-in. So I think the point here is that, you know, it is not just on food, right? We are experiencing our own issues here in the States, and these are just two charts of the University of Michigan buying conditions, both between vehicles and houses. And for those who can't see it, it's basically a chart where it's like pretty level for the last 9 years, and then basically in 2022 it just completely collapses. And what it's saying is that the conditions across car buying and home buying have effectively fallen off a cliff and are at now 10-year lows. And, you know, we're also seeing pretty strong kind of upticks in revolving credit balances, so aka credit cards, right? So that's also something interesting to note, that consumers are now starting to tap into credit to pay for things.
Yeah, and younger consumers are getting hooked on BNPL.
Yes, and I have some... Maybe for another episode down the line, but I was reading some stuff about BNPL, and it was it's not good.
Pay later, by the way.
Yes, exactly.
For those.
But anyway, so this next chart is about consumer sentiment, and you know this is not going to be surprising to anyone, I don't think. But you know, this is the consumer sentiment index again, at University of Michigan, and it's at all time lows, right? So the consumer sentiment has hit lows. And this number is actually as of May, and the June number, which we got, I think, last week, is even lower than this. So, you know, consumer is not feeling very good. And, but, you know, I don't think that's a particular surprising statement. On the job front, after, you know, months of a booming job market, we're really starting to see some cracks. And, you know, there's this great website called layoffs.fyi that I would encourage folks to kind of just take a look at. It tracks tech layoffs, and what they do is they basically say the number of folks that were laid off and percentage, but companies, at least according to this website, cut almost 9 times more jobs in May than in the first 4 months of the year, right? So that that unemployment rate number that everyone's been sort of, or at least policymakers have been bragging about, I think that's very likely going to change.
I'll just mention, though, that this website, layoffs.fyi, is sadly, it's a really great asset, and it has been so since the throes of lockdown back in 2020. But I think you noticed a huge upswing, you know, back then related to COVID and all of the shocks that imposed on the system. But yeah, it's it is sad, you know, that we're seeing this begin to pick back up pretty substantially.
Yeah. And by the way, I highly recommend that, especially if you're hiring, to take a look at that website, because it does list everyone who was laid off and affected. And I think it is voluntary. You have to opt in, but, there's a lot of great sort of, folks there that are waiting to be hired. So highly recommend taking a look at it. I'll just quickly note crypto, everyone's favorite topic.
Onto Mo's favorite topic.
Everyone's favorite topic. You know, we're seeing a real systemic failure in the crypto industry, that really stemmed from the Terra Luna stablecoin collapse from earlier in the year, which originally was thought to be just a speed bump in prices, but it ended up becoming systemic. And it's not surprising that it honestly became systemic, because the capital loss and value destruction that came from the Terra stablecoin collapse was bigger than Lehman, by almost 10, 15 billion.
Let me just interject and just point out the magnitude of this graph that we have for those who are just listening. Mt. Gox was, you know, this famous hack, I think two crypto cycles ago, and it barely registers the damage that you know, the lost value from that barely registers against Lehman Brothers. And then that itself, as you're pointing out, kind of not, it's quite a bit less than the whole Terra kabobble.
Yeah.
Fiasco.
No, that's right. And I mean, since then, you know, we've had, you know, crypto exchanges, from a market value perspective collapse. I mean, Coinbase year to date is down like 80%. Celsius may file for bankruptcy. That's a crypto lending platform. Bitcoin, Ethereum are down 60 to 70% year to date. And all this is to say is I do believe that we're going to see some significant crypto regulation coming. The SEC, you know, has been effectively waiting for this moment to pounce. And I do think we're going to see some regulation. IPO liquidity has collapsed. So this just really shows you the extent of market demand and market appetite right now. We went from $160 billion last year in IPO volume to where, you know, we're halfway through the year and we're only at around $5 billion, which is, I mean, a complete collapse, which also makes you wonder what happens to all those record investment banking salaries that were paid out last year.
Definitely not as much deal making on the SPAC front.
No, and we're gonna. I think I have a chart on that later. But on the private market side, you know, not surprisingly, you know, we're seeing a record imbalance in sell side interest versus buy side demand. So in other words, way more sellers than buyers of private shares. And you know, we all know that, you know, private markets in effect operate at a lag in terms of valuation. But there's no question that there's a lot of investors out there who are very hesitant to mark their books down, and VCs out there that are hesitant to do so. But, you know, it's definitely coming. You know, you look at Instacart, Epic Games, Klarna, FTX, GoPuff. These are some, you know, these are big growth rounds that happened last year. They're all down, you know, 30, 40, 50%. And in Q1, only 5% of VC funding were down rounds. And that's definitely going to change. We know that number. There's no question.
Yeah, that's like six months to a year.
Exactly.
6 months behind.
And interestingly, the most active liquid markets in private secondaries was actually aerospace and defense. I'm not sure what to make of that.
Yeah. Well, let's refer to that as A&D going forward, because that's a lot. That's a term commonly used in the investment community, but. What are some of the catalysts
exactly.
or tailwinds that you see driving that?
You know, I don't know. I actually think it might be as simple as like SpaceX. Like there's probably a significant number of SpaceX shares that traded in Q2. That's kind of, that would be my guess actually.
Yeah. So it's also, I would imagine, sort of an average versus relative thing. You know, some of the world's biggest startups might be more susceptible to down rounds were they to raise as compared to SpaceX, which again is a, you know, one of the world's biggest private companies and not as affected as will come up multiple times in this discussion. You know, A&D is not going to be affected by a downturn as much as a consumer focused fintech or NFT
right.
marketplace
That's right.
platform.
That's right. But what's next, right? So we're seeing, you know, we're seeing underperformance across all major markets, S&P 500, NASDAQ, bonds, Bitcoin. The average stock in the NASDAQ or Russell Growth is down 40 to 50% from peak levels globally. And, you know, Chinese internet stocks have fallen something like, you know, over 70%, which basically matches the decline that we saw in NASDAQ. Cathie Woods, which was the poster child and her ARK, ARK Invest, which is a poster child for like innovation and disruptive investing, is down 70%. And in fact, if you invested at the start of the ARK Innovation ETF and you invested in the S&P 500, you were better off. I think S&P 500 is now outperforming.
Yeah. A couple months ago, there was the flippening in that the inverse ARK flipped the ARK ETF and started outperforming.
Interesting. That is very interesting. So yeah, I think, so this is just to say, like, you know, we've had this huge sort of sell-off, but, you know, I actually don't, I don't think we're at cheap levels, right? We're far from it. NASDAQ, if you look at the NASDAQ just alone, right, it's trading at 4x sales, which is just a multiple used to kind of judge sort of valuation on these indices. But if you actually look at the last 10 years, it's actually still at the high end of the range. The NASDAQ for most of the last 10 years was trading between 2 and 4x, and we're now at 4x. So we're not necessarily cheap. And I think what you really need to watch out for and really, you know, when we're going to get that bottom in the market is likely going to coincide with peak inflation, meaning like when those inflation numbers have topped out. And hopefully it was last month. But if it wasn't, then like I think that's what the market's going to be looking out for, because it's going to indicate how much the Fed will have to tighten. So in terms of raise rates, like, because they're effectively battling inflation. So knowing how much the how far they have to go is going to depend on when we hit peak inflation. And the IMF actually a few months ago predicted that peak inflation would happen sometime in the summer. And so far they're looking like they've been correct. So anyway, my feeling is that equity markets have not reached the bottom yet.
Time for a short break to hear about our sponsors again. Space is the new frontier for cybersecurity. SpiderHawk Mission Systems builds space cybersecurity solutions for civilian, military, and commercial space operations. Their OrbitSecure protocol delivers zero-trust security to zero-gravity environments, protecting space communication, command, control, data transmission, storage, and integrity at the data level. To learn more about how zero-trust architectures will revolutionize security in new space, download the new NSR SpiderHawk-sponsored white paper, titled Space Cybersecurity, Current State and Future Needs. Find the white paper at spacecyber.com. Again, that's spacecyber.com. Or check out their website at spideroak-ms.com. And tell them Pathfinder sent you. So this is one of our text heavier slides. So I would say high level summaries here. And for those who are more curious, we'll of course link the full deck in the show notes. And if you're watching, you can pause and just read through all of this.
Yeah, so I'll just hit the three bullets real quick. So basically, because of inflation, we can't look at traditional mechanisms to support the market. This is just really pointing to the Fed used to be able to lower rates and help support the economy. We can't do that anymore because we're in a rising rate cycle.
The bazooka is gone.
And now what we're seeing, this is very different from the financial crisis, the global financial crisis. This is a deliberate bursting of the bubble by the Fed. They are bringing down asset prices on purpose. And that's something really important to note, because that is not what happened in the financial crisis, which was a systemic failure in the banking system. But anyway, there's still some hope. Tech today is very different than what it was in the 2000s. Technology is, it basically permeates throughout our entire lives, both on consumer side and enterprise. Tech in the 2000s was really about like when you used it, when you needed it. So like, I don't know, pets.com, you ordered food when you needed to, but now we all know that, you know, we interact with technology companies and apps and connect to the cloud. So it's very different and it permeates and the industry's grown up.
I would love to know, and neither of us have it in front of us, but just what smartphone penetration rates alone looked like back then versus now. It's night and day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So now getting to the good stuff. So this is a chart for those that can't see. It's basically digital world assets versus real world assets.
This is fascinating.
So for the listeners, we have two indices, one that represents real world equities. So linked to food, energy, mining, aerospace, physical products, right? Used to effectively build the US infrastructure, versus digital, right? Which represents software, cybersecurity, like metaverse, food delivery,
metaverse.
Gaming, cloud computing, right? Metaverse, exactly. In other words, basically the millennial portfolio, And the outperformance of real versus digital is incredibly stark, right? And this isn't surprising, but it sets us up really well for what we care about, right? Yeah, payload, which is aerospace and defense.
I'll just add, though, that this probably goes hand in hand with a lot of the big macro trends we're going to see over the next few years, which is, you know, my prediction, this is not by any means empirical, but I would imagine you'll see software engineers decamping from like a B2B SaaS company to work at maybe one of these A&D or industrial companies. And you know, with reshoring manufacturing capacity and everything, I think that the real world index is going to be a more bullish outlook comparatively or relatively speaking in the years to come.
No, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, the A&D industry is really, is being supported, for a number of different reasons. And we'll talk about that in a second, but I will say that the index, the performance, at least in the public markets of the aerospace and defense, index versus the S&P 500 and NASDAQ is really, it's very, very stark, right? The aerospace industry, index effectively this year is flat in terms of performance. Now, normally you'd be like, okay, well, that's not that great, but compared to the S&P 500, that's down 20% and the NASDAQ down 30%. It's actually a huge outperformance. And in fact, some of the primes like Lockheed and Northrop are actually up even more than that, like 10, 15, 20%. So now we know why that's happening, right? There's sort of the obvious reason, which is of course the Eastern European conflict. You know, we're seeing defense budgets dramatically increase around the world. I think the latest,
especially in Europe,
right? You know, we saw an increase in defense budgets this year alone, even before the conflict. But outside of that, there is a tremendous amount of space investment that's happening. 2021 was a record year for government space investment, something like $92 billion, of which 20% actually went to defense. I think that's a Euroconsult number. And then President Biden requested a $26 billion budget for NASA in fiscal year 2023, which was the highest request ever for the agency.
And I'll just note that we have this graph here, and if you had added the payload space back index, it would be like off the bottom.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Actually, we have that in a couple slides. So global military expenditures have now exceeded $2 trillion per year for the first time, right? And that a lot of that, like you said earlier, is being driven by Europe. But this is all to say that we should expect that aerospace to defense investment levels are going to remain high for the foreseeable future, right? There's almost no question about that at this point.
And teeing you up for, yeah, the space-specific impacts, especially with what's going on. Well, you know, exclusively because of what's going on in Eastern Europe. We have this next slide.
Correct. Exactly. And we don't have to go through all this, but really, you know, the Russia-Ukraine conflict is really accelerating the race for space dominance in a way. You know, on the launch side, Russia's been refusing to launch satellites for OneWeb. You know, they don't allow European partners to use their spaceports anymore. They've stopped selling their RD-180 engines to U.S. Providers, and that's affecting ULA and Northrop Grumman. On the cyber side, you know, there's been jamming of Viasat and Starlink internet services, and a lot of folks think it's coming from Russia. And of course, the space station, although things look patched up right now, I think there is this, you know, like kind of behind the scenes, I think, tension, right, between US and Russia right now on the ISS.
I noted as much in our first episode, actually, with Michael Suffrandini, that the tensions, the earthly tensions, have at the very least rhetorically reached the International Space Station.
Yeah, exactly.
But practically speaking, it's still a little bit of a different story. I want to emphasize the massive impact on launch. Like, I think it was something like a third or a fourth of all global launch capacity basically overnight, you know, went offline for Western payloads. So that has a massive impact on the Western launch ecosystem.
Yeah, no, it does. And I mean that coupled with the fact that I actually do think that our launch supply is severely constrained in general because of, you know, the Falcon 9 rideshare. I mean, it takes, you have to book out ways in advance for that now. I think Kuiper just bought out like 2 years worth of like launch services from another provider.
Took a lot more capacity offline.
Yeah, there's a lot of capacity just went offline. And then like the issue with Russia just makes it even worse. So it's definitely, there's an opportunity for launch, I think. That's for sure.
All of our launch listeners will be pleased to hear this part.
Yeah, exactly. But it is a bit of a tale of two cities, right? You have the traditional aerospace and defense companies that are doing very well because, you know, clearly there is a significant dual use to what they do. And in most cases, a primary use, but there's that defense angle too. But, you know, I think more, if you look at the pure play space startups, there is still some challenges. This is just a chart on the amount of capital that was raised in investment. And, you know, it was a record last few years. We just kept increasing the total amount of space investment that was occurring in 2021, topped it off with almost near $16 billion.
Mo, just to be a methodological stickler, is this inclusive of, you know, SPAC transactions and de-SPACs?
Yep, it is. It's inclusive of public transactions as well. Exactly. It's basically all space investment. So anyway, big numbers, things were looking very, very good. SPACs were in some cases considered the savior, and these are just some headlines from last year, but how SPACs are changing the investment landscape for space. Space infrastructure is the next frontier for and SPAC for Launchpad. Space SPAC soar as Kathy Wood's ARK Invest expected to launch the ARK space exploration ETF. So basically a lot of these like very very, very like, hey, like SPACs are here, there's liquidity, space investing is cool, let's like really dive in, right? That was really the kind of mantra of like late 2020 into 2021. But it's important to remember that how quickly the macro can flip. And this is a chart of Exxon's market cap versus Zoom's. And if you recall, a year and a half ago, there were headlines of Zoom overtaking legacy, another, you know, flipping industry giant, another flipping, exactly, industry giant Exxon, and how, you know, Zoom's market cap took over Exxon, all these articles, oh, this is a new, changing of the guard, new world order. And now you have, you know, one war and interest rate hike cycle later, Exxon is, 10 to 13 times bigger than Zoom.
Yeah, that is very illustrative.
Yeah. So this is just really, just to really say, like, it's obviously also important to be humble. Like things can look really good, but like, hey, that, you know, you, sometimes you kind of have to step back and ask yourself, like, why is this happening? Right. And what are the reasons why this is happening, and can this change? And clearly they have. And this is the index that you were mentioning, our space SPAC index. But the SPAC market has completely collapsed. And space really, there's basically been nowhere to hide if you're in SPAC, if you're in the SPAC game.
Yeah. I'll also mention, it's a little bit off topic, but this space SPAC index that we keep referencing, and we've referenced it a bunch in the newsletter, we're dog fooding it right now, but we plan on eventually releasing some sort of public product that for the world, so that we're not the only ones that get to use and enjoy and learn from it.
Yeah, no, exactly. Hopefully this summer is actually the plan. But anyway, the entire group is down something like 50%. And some companies specifically within that index are down over 90%, right? So so what happened here, right? I think companies went public too early. When you're a public company, you actually have to hit your forecasts. And I think that's what was forgotten a little bit last year. And if you don't, you get punished. And it's not just the company's fault, right? I actually firmly, I would point my fingers at the bankers too. They created an environment that encouraged companies to put out crazy forecasts. And in fact, there were banks that underwrote these SPACs and helped create forecasts in those investor presentations. And, when you, as a bank, when you underwrite a company and do an investment banking transaction, you have to, the research side of the house has to cover them within, I think, like 90 days. But effectively what you saw is 3 months later, the same banks, the analysts that were writing the reports had completely different projections from the projections that the banks put together for the SPAC presentations, right? So I'm not going to say anything about that, but I mean, I think you can just kind of read between the lines. look, the
people can connect the dots.
Exactly. And look, the public markets are not where you fund R&D. It doesn't work. Biotech is probably the only sector that the market actually accepts those types of binary outcomes. And you know, this is just this, the SPAC is actually a very beautiful mechanism to take a company public, but it doesn't work, when you take advantage of it and it was taken advantage of.
And I'll add, you know, just when there's a long and winding and by no means preordained path to profitability.
Exactly. So what do I think is going to happen, like, going forward? I think we're going to see I think there's going to be some consolidation. And I think there could be some companies that just fail. And when you look at their burn rates, how far they are from a commercially viable product, you know, the numbers just don't work. And those companies are not going to be able to tap the follow-on market. So when you typically are a public company and you need more money, you can go back into the market and say, hey, I need more money. I'm going to take more dilution. And here's how much money I need to raise. Like, that happens all the time.
I think we've seen that happen already a couple of times within that SPAC index that we have. In the past 2 months, memory serves.
No, exactly. But I think the companies are going to have a lot of trouble doing that going forward, and they're going to get into cash burn issues. And you know, there could easily be some consolidation. But ultimately, I think this is a good thing for the market because we need that shakeout. When capital goes into an industry and it goes in very inefficiently, it's not a great thing for the future of the industry. Like, you need some level of you need a shakeout. You need companies that were poorly managed. And I'm not saying the companies that have gone public are poorly managed. I mean, in general, you need to see some level of...
Broadly speaking, there are certainly SPACs. I'm not referring specifically to the space sector, but there are plenty of examples to that effect. Mismanagement.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So anyway, this is all to say that I do think it's a good thing.
So... I'll link to this in the show notes, but Anton Breivik, and apologies, Anton, if I'm butchering that. I think I probably am. Damn American. But he had a really great thread recently, and I know that you two engaged on Twitter a little bit about it. But the essence of it was that the end of the first chapter of new space history is closing, and just some companies' struggles might have, you know, there's going to be consolidation. There's a lot of parallels with what you were saying, but essentially that there's going to be this shakeout. And I wanted to hear, and again, I'll link to the full thread. And I think he also had a blog post about it, so I'll link to that as well, but wanted to hear your impressions of that.
No, I think Anton hit the nail on the head. I think that there is definitely going to be a level of coming back to reality. I think there were companies that raised a lot of money on great ideas, but ideas that really the market isn't quite ready for. And I think the gist of his piece, and I don't want to give away the whole thing because I'd love for people to go and read it, is that, you know, I think his point really stuck on this this sort of focus on commercial viability. And the idea is effectively, like, is this a first order solution? Meaning, like, are there customers for this, like, now? Or is it some service that requires, like, one or two other layers and levels of the economy to develop and become, it's in order to become a viable business model?
And Mo, might an example of that be the topic of the Twitter spaces that you moderated and payload hosted yesterday? For those who didn't catch it, it was on in-space manufacturing. Might that be an example of this phenomenon you're referring to?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think I'm very fascinated by the in-space manufacturing industry. I think there's a lot of really great use cases, and it's certainly exciting that there are all these companies that are going after this this opportunity. I think the jury is still out on the two things. One, which is, like, the unit economics on some of the early products that are being built. And I know that that's a bit of a controversial statement, because I know that there are folks that feel very strongly about the fact that the economics are there. But I do think that that needs to be somewhat proven, and the demand for those products in space, and also, like, whether like a space made product it fits into the supply chain of an earth made product. We don't need to get into the complexities of what that means, but I think that's
that could be its own podcast. Yeah.
So that, and I think the other side of the equation is scaling, right? So it's one thing to be able to build a product, build a few products profitably, but like, you know, do we have the ability now to scale in space manufacturing, right? So I do think that in order to make it, you're going to need to be a company that knows how to raise money. And that's going to be hugely important, right? I think, I've talked to startups about this all the time, which is, and I try to give this feedback, like, you know, very, very head on, which is you are an awesome founder or management team. You have a really cool product. Clearly, you know, you're the right team to do it, but you need to be able to be the visionary. And that you need to be able to excite the other side of the table, because ultimately a good idea is half the battle. You need to be able to raise money. And the unfortunate truth is a lot of these companies are very capital intensive, and you need to be able to go out and raise capital. So I don't think, I think sometimes, especially in the startup community, not enough emphasis is placed, especially when in these kind of frontier technology verticals, on the vision piece of it. And like, why is this so exciting? Why is this so important? Why is this going to change your life? And you need to be able to sell that vision. And truthfully, it's why Elon is such a great fundraiser. Like, he is a master fundraiser. And a lot of people think they're Elon, but they're not.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like, you know, storytelling and marketing built in to the product and the leadership, such that they don't need to spend any money on advertising or anything like that. But we're getting a little bit far afield here. Do you think, though, that the performance, let's say, of SPACs, and just, I'm not going to say space is hard, because two guests have said, stop saying that. So we're not going to say that. But, you know, as you're saying, the unit economics are difficult. The cost structure, it's super capital intensive. And now, given this, you know, drawdown that we have discussed extensively this morning, will that have a chilling effect? And we have tons of space specialist investors and, you know, deep tech focused funds that are some of our greatest listeners and friends. So shout out to them. This is not in reference to them at all, because they've been doing this, right? This is their bread and butter. But I think we've seen crossover funds and more generalist investors in recent years backing some of these space companies, growth stage space companies. Do you think that all of these factors that we've discussed, especially in this portion of the conversation, that will have a chilling effect on them and that they'll just exit space? Do you worry about that at all?
It's a very fair question. I worry about it a little bit, but not much. I think that ebbs and flows in capital creation and destruction happens in markets all the time. And I think we're just going down the road a little bit of sort of the what Anton's article was alluding to, which is a bit of a slowdown period, and you know, a new wave of space companies that kind of arise from that.
Yeah, and I'll just keep the Pathfinder payload plug flywheel spinning. Rob Meyerson had a really, back on episode 2, if folks weren't able to catch that, he had a really good answer about all of this. So I would refer you to that for further discussion of this topic.
Yes, that was a great episode. Rob's awesome. But to kind of further the point here, I think there is a really interesting chart that I saw recently. Unfortunately, it's not in the deck, but it's the number of eventual unicorns by founding year.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so it's a really telling chart.
It's really popular for fintech companies.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I'd never seen it before. And I was like, wow, this is actually really interesting. So it's a really telling chart for investors. Basically, from 06 to 09, call it, right? Really sort of like right at the start and towards the end of the financial crisis, the number of unicorn companies that were founded in those years were like sub 25, right?
Mo, just for listeners, at our offsite last week, Mo did have this slide. And not to toot my own horn, but there was no title. There were just question marks. And it was like a bunch of these brands, and, you know, companies like, can you give some examples?
Yeah. Like, Airbnb, Slack, Uber,
Exactly. these huge success stories. And he's like, what do these all have in common? And I was like, they were started during downturns.
Correct. Exactly. So like, and it's not just during the downturn, it's the period following the downturn as well, right? So if you actually look at that chart, I wish I put it in the deck, the number explodes for the next 7 years. Yeah, so that number explodes for the next 7 years. So if you were a venture investor and started during the recession, you made an incredible amount of money, right? Which is why, like, you know, there are so many storied investors. A16Z, I mean, I think sometimes people forget A16Z started in the global financial crisis.
Last guest, Catherine Boyle. Another plug.
Exactly. So it's just something to keep in mind. Like, you know, these are sort of the times when you need to kind of roll up your sleeves as an investor and ask yourself, like, you know, what has happened over the last couple of years that got us here? But like, what's the next, like, you know, 5-10 years going to look like? And there's no question that the space economy is going to be one of the biggest industries in the world. It already is, to an effect. But it will be, I think it will be the biggest, one of the biggest industries in the world. So, and there's a lot of reasons why. And I think I can wrap up the presentation here with these last couple of slides, because I think they allude to it, which is that, you know, this space race that we're in, which we are in a space race, will be one of the biggest technological contests of the decade, right? And if you actually look back, you know, the global space race, you know, back in sort of the 50s and the 60s, you know, at the time it was just US and Russia, right? But now there's over 80 countries that have active space programs that are all aiming to generate economic return. They've all, like, almost all of them in their sort of like manifesto are trying to generate economic returns. And of course the beast in the room, you know, outside of the US is China. And their progress in developing space technology is unmatched. They launched the first astronaut into space in 2003. And since then, they became the first country to land a probe on the far side of the moon, second country ever to land a rover on Mars, the third to bring back lunar soil to Earth, and many other things, right? You know, they're developing the next gen competitor to GPS. You know, they're going to complete a space station later this year, exactly Beidou. You know, they're aiming to launch mega constellations for satellite broadband. And they are actually, I think I'm right on this, but I think they're the only country that is labeled a year on which they will send humans to Mars. Not counting Elon, but yeah, the NASA hasn't said when they're going to send.
Yeah, the private nation state of Elon.
Yes, he has, but he's apparent. According to him, he's sending people to Mars in like 2 years. But you know, they said, like, China has said that they're going to land humans on Mars by 2033, and the government estimates that the Earth Moon sort of economic zone, call it the cislunar economy, is going to generate something like $10 trillion a year on investment by 2050.
That's a bold prediction. I mean, you and I,
very bold.
You and I have some qualms with the projections about, you know, the space market reaching $1 trillion and those big flashy headline grabbing reports. And those are on a much shorter time frame. So, but hey, you gotta toss a number out there when you hear it.
Yeah, but I think the
it's a best guess.
No, it's I mean, it definitely is much more of a guess than anything. But I will say that what it does tell us is that there are countries like China out there that are very focused on this. They're politically coordinated, and they're technologically savvy. And there's going to be an enormous amount of capital investment from these countries in space. There's no question. And I think the question for us in the United States is, do we want to maintain our space dominance? And I think the answer is yes. I think everyone, even the government, would say, yes, of course, we want to maintain our space dominance. So the amount of government funding and government support on all of these cool projects that we're working on. And there's no question, by the way, going back to your earlier point, Ryan, on, you know, what the next, you know, level of investment is going to look like. I think the government's going to need to step up, and I think they will step up. And I think they're going to have to, you know, really support it, like R&D where VCs really can't, you know, are afraid to be, right?
Yeah, basic research, that sort of thing. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, just to wrap up here, what is the implications of all of this, right? So, Space militarization is becoming a priority in sort of this race for technological supremacy. We talked about China. The country does not separate its commercial and defense-related space activities, and U.S. is taking notice. And, you know, the United States is going to have to significantly increase funding and prioritize its space strategy if they want to retain leadership. And to what we were mentioning earlier, in the near term, there will be a shakeout in the industry, on the commercial space industry, but it's going to pave the way for better run, more efficient business models. And probably if you could take it.
I'd point out, though, that I do think that the share of, yes, God, this is not a hot take at all, but the share of, you know, government, both civil and military, owning and operating versus procuring from the commercial sector. And, you know, this is something we have touched on, but I want to put a fine point on it and explicitly mention it. You know, the NRO, like a spy agency, just bought, you know, awarded its biggest electro-optical contracts ever. And of course, NASA is famously moving more contracts and work to fixed price versus cost plus. And so that's just another tailwind, I suppose, that I would call out.
No, that's right. That's totally right. But yeah, I think that my last sort of takeaway for folks listening, I think if there's one thing that you could take away from all this, is to go watch For All Mankind on Apple TV. And Brian, how many times have I already said that to the team?
Oh my God. It's like Apple's paying you, but I promise y'all, he said it 7 times in the past week. But I watched the first 2 episodes on my flight home from the Northeast, and then I watched 2 last night. And so I'm, you know, still firmly in like 1969 in this alternative history. If you spend a lot of time on tech Twitter and you're very online, you know, this is what you would call a counterfactual show about what happened if a certain other Cold War country and spacefaring superpower landed on the moon first. But for regular people, if you're a normal person, like, it's just an alternative history, and it's great. I can't say enough about that. And Mo, you actually 2 birds, 1 stone there, because I like to ask, I've asked some of our guests about their favorite works of sci-fi, but for my second end of show, you know, quicker, lighter question, I think it's really good, especially for us to humanize, you know, the employees of Payload a bit, and not just be talking about economic drawdowns for the whole show. Do you have any hobbies? What are your hobbies?
Good question. I think you know the answer to this already, but
I do.
One of my biggest passions is music. And you know, I could delete every single app on my phone, but I would never delete Spotify. I love music, but the way that translates into a hobby is I produce dance music, and I DJ.
Mo's a DJ. And this is cue the Admiral Akbar. It's a trap. This is a forcing function. While we're live on podcast, we are going to replace our intro and outro song with music that was made by Mo.
All right. Now
I hope I do not get fired.
Now I'm definitely on the spot. So I got to deliver. I used to do it very regularly. I used to play in the nightclub circuit in New York for many years. It was really fun. It was very hard to do that and also maintain a banking job, but you know, we made it work.
Another question that I sometimes ask is, how many hours of sleep do you get, or do you ever sleep?
Sleep is tough these days. Sleep is very tough. But you know that more than anyone as well.
Oh my God. Yeah. As I learned very, very quickly and painfully, one, rockets, launches, none of that adheres to a 9 to 5 Eastern workday, but space just doesn't sleep. That's the shorthand that I use to explain to people why I almost always have bags under my eyes.
Yeah. Well, you've been crushing it. So thanks for all your hard work.
Yeah. Again, Mo is actually my prisoner. So. On this podcast, so I'm forcing him to say nice
exactly
things. So last question before we close out here, and it's I'll give you a choice of which one you want to answer. Make some predictions on when we get boots back, and I'm actually going to say not as in the United States, but when humanity gets boots back on the moon, and then when they get boots for the first time on Mars. The second question is, when do you think you, Mo Islam, would be able to go to low Earth orbit for any amount of time. And so assume that means that space travel is affordable enough that it would be sort of a rather large discretionary purchase for someone who is in the top 10% of incomes in the United States.
Yeah, I think that it's a good question. So, okay, let me start with the boots on the moon first. I think that that will happen definitely in this decade. And I know I'm giving myself a lot of wiggle room, but like I could say like, oh, 2027, but it would just be a random guess. I think in this decade, we're going to be on the moon. I think the Mars question is a bit, I think Mars really depends on Starship.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that's another topic for another day, is just the impact of Starship, the potential impact of Starship. I know a lot of folks smarter than me have thought about this a lot.
By the way, we didn't even talk about that. If Starship comes online, on time or sooner than people think, then this whole idea of economics and unit economics and all that stuff that we were talking about sort of becomes not relevant anymore, right?
Yeah, yeah. It some might say it's not priced in.
Yeah. No, I don't think it's, I mean, it's a great point that I don't think it's priced in. You know, if there's anyone that's ever going to be able to get this done, it's going to be Elon, and he's going to get it done. There's no question. But Starship is the big, linchpin around how quickly we get to Mars. And I think that, this is what I would say is my prediction. I think we get to the moon in the next decade, and I think we get to Mars very soon after that. I don't think it's going to be like 10 years to moon and then another 10 years to Mars. I think they're going to happen almost, planning is going to happen somewhat concurrently. I think maybe we'll, you know, have boots on the ground, on the moon a few different times, multiple times before we get to Mars. But I think Mars will happen very soon after the moon. So I would say early 2030s, pre-2035.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, history doesn't repeat. It rhymes, some say, but I mean, it's going to be a lot different this time. It'll be a sustained presence, I'd imagine, on the moon. There's going to be the gateway. So yeah, I mean, obviously that's why we're in this business, right? That's why this company was started, is because we are at an inflection point, as someone smart that I know likes to say in their Twitter bio.
There we go. Ryan, thanks so much for having me. It was a total pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Mo, thanks for coming on the show. And for everyone who listened, thanks for making it this far. As a reminder, if you're not signed up to Payload, go to payloadspace.com to read our industry-leading space newsletter on all the goings-on off Earth. And again, this conversation, I think we gave enough context that you can listen to it and be totally fine. But if you do want to watch it, you'll get the full picture, quite literally, full video, and it'll be available on Spotify and YouTube. But for now, that is all we have. I'm Ryan Duffy signing off, and I will see you next week.